Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. FedEx offers fast delivery, more visibility, simple returns, and weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. population on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. With FedEx, you get picture proof of delivery, ensuring you always know where your package is. Returns are simple with packageless and paperless returns. Plus, FedEx Ground is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. So, what are you waiting for? See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Tesla CEO Elon Musk tweeted yesterday that former President Donald Trump's platform, Truth Social, has a terrible name. Okay, Elon Musk.
From 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York City, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with actor Andrew Garfield. But first, a closer look.
A member of the committee investigating the January 6th insurrection revealed what he called the most chilling moment from that day. While three more Trump allies, including Kevin McCarthy and Marjorie Taylor Greene, were caught lying about their roles in the attempted coup. Oh, and also Donald Trump said in a lawsuit that he's afraid of getting hit with dangerous fruits. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. Every day, it seems like we get more bombshell reporting about what happened on January 6th and who was involved. And now, on top of everything else we've already learned, we have what one member of the committee investigating the insurrection called the most chilling anecdote yet, an account of something Vice President Mike Pence said in the Capitol as the riot was unfolding.
Democratic Representative Jamie Raskin of Maryland, who is a member of the House 1-6 Select Committee, said the committee's upcoming public hearings will, quote, tell a story that will really blow the roof off the House. At an event in Washington, D.C., Raskin spoke about what he called a chilling moment from January the 6th involving former Vice President Mike Pence. After rioters stormed the halls of Congress, some chanting, hang Mike Pence, the Vice President's Secret Service agents rushed him to a secure location inside the Capitol. Those agents, who Raskin says he suspects, were reporting to Trump's Secret Service agents, then tried to whisk Pence away from the Capitol. That's when the congressman says Pence uttered what he called the six most chilling words he's heard throughout this entire investigation. Quote, I'm not getting in that car.
I'm guessing that's when Pence went into full chameleon mode. You know that thing he does where he closes his eyes and sits totally still, hoping no one will notice him?
This is not happening. You are not here. You are in your happy place at a public library burning a pile of Harry Potter books.
That's how nefarious this plot was and how deep it went. Trump's own vice president suspected the Secret Service might be involved. Almost every day, it seems, more evidence emerges that implicates yet another member of Trump's inner circle. And nearly every day, those same people get caught lying about it, like Trump's former energy secretary, Rick Perry, who denied to CNN that he ever proposed ideas to Trump's chief of staff, Mark Meadows, for how to overturn the election results, before text messages turned up in which Perry was caught saying exactly that. And Perry even went out of his way to make clear he was the one writing the text messages.
Trump's former energy secretary, Rick Perry, former governor of Texas, texts Meadows, quote, we have the data-driven program that can clearly show where the fraud was committed. This is the silver bullet. Just for the record, previously, we've reported at CNN another Rick Perry text. He denied it. It was his phone. CNN has confirmed from multiple sources, friends and colleagues of his, that is his phone number. These texts were coming from. In fact, these texts on the Meadows log show that he signed his name and his telephone number at the end of the text.
I think if you're going to pitch ideas for a coup, then lie about it. Maybe don't sign your text messages with your name and phone number. Did he also send a follow-up text that said, there's a lot of Rick Perrys out there, so here's a pic of me sending this text. I will say, if you've ever texted with an older person, like a parent or an in-law, you've probably witnessed the same behavior. They all sign their text messages with their names, like they're writing Civil War letters home. Dear Clarabelle, I hope this missive finds you well. I write to relay the most unfortunate news. I regret to inform you I have been searching in vain for well-priced aluminum siding at Lowe's. Cheryl, your mother, says I should simply acquiesce and pay for the siding at current cost, but I say, nay, good lady, I shall not succumb to such price gougery. Hope you're well. Sincerely, your father, Robert Jennings. P.S. The dog has been on the rug again. The circle of Trump cronies involved in the coup keeps getting wider and wider to the point where it seems like virtually the entirety of the Trump administration and his closest allies in Congress were involved in some way, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who we now know is also texting Meadows more than a week after the insurrection about the possibility of Trump declaring martial law to stay in power, an idea that had been advocated by Trump allies like Michael Flynn and Mike Lindell. Only Greene misspelled the word martial in the dumbest possible way.
3 days before the inauguration, Marjorie Taylor Greene sent this text message to Mark Meadows, quote, in our private chat with only members, several are saying the only way to save our republic is for Trump to call for martial law. Note on your screen, she misspells the word martial.
That's right. She spelled it like the name Marshall. Now, in her defense, Marjorie Taylor Greene probably just confused martial law with Marshall's law, which she violates every time she tries to bring more than 6 items into the changing room, at which point she's escorted from the store screaming, it's my constitutional right to find comfortable slacks at a reasonable price. And then last night, in an interview with Fox News host Laura Ingraham, Greene implied that the text messages in question might not even be hers, while also insisting that if they were hers, she wasn't actually asking Trump to declare martial law. She was just letting him know that it was something that was being discussed.
Those are reportedly my text messages. I think if people read them for themselves, if those are my text messages, they clearly say that I wasn't calling for that. I actually said that's something I don't know about. That was what those text messages say.
So you didn't advocate, right now there's you never advocated martial law, that President Trump should use martial law to stop, you know, the transition of power. You never advocated for that, did you?
I don't recall ever advocating for martial law. I don't know if you have that up on the screen right now because I can't see it. But if you put that text message up, it's clear and easy to read that if that's my text messages and that's what they're reporting, I don't recall if they are. But if they are, those text messages do not say calling for martial law.
So you don't know if the texts, which you've seen, were actually yours. You sound like a werewolf trying to piece things together the next morning. Look, I don't recall eating any villagers, but if that's why there's blood on my nightshirt, then I guess I forgot to chain myself to the bed. Also, can we go back to this?
I don't know if you have that up on the screen right now because I can't see it.
I like that she accidentally asked Ingraham, are you going to do any journalism? And Ingraham said no. Fox News reacts to the question, are you going to do journalism, the way Larry David reacts to a dinner invite. Larry, you want to come over tonight? Come on, I'll drive you. Hey, I'm not getting in that car. They all do the same thing. Lie, get caught lying, then talk in nonsense word salad circles of inscrutable bull to try to get out of it. The same thing happened with House GOP leader Kevin McCarthy after he denied a report that he told fellow Republicans in the days after the insurrection that he would urge Trump to resign. And then audio surfaced of the phone call in which McCarthy said he would urge Trump to resign. After the audio surfaced, McCarthy held a press conference where he tried to claim he hadn't lied when he denied the initial report, but his answer made no sense whatsoever.
The reporter never asked me that question. The reporter came to me the night before he released the book, and my understanding was he was saying that I asked President Trump to resign. No, I never did, and that's what I was answering. If you're asking now, did I tell my members that we're going to ask them if I told any of them that I said President Trump? The answer is no.
Your claim is that you weren't lying when you deny that you said you would urge Trump to resign because the reporter asked you if you urged Trump to resign, which you claim you didn't. And if we want to know if you told your members you would urge Trump to resign, We should ask your members if you told them you would urge him to resign, instead of just listening to the audio where you told them you would urge Trump to resign. I feel like I just spent an hour trying to find an exit in an M.C. Escher painting. Why would we ask your members if you said it? We have the audio of you telling your members impeachment would pass and Trump should resign.
The only discussion I would have with him is that I think this will pass, and it would be my recommendation you should resign.
Oh, that wasn't me. That was my friend Marshall Law. Here's my question about everything we've learned so far. In addition to being horrifying and dangerous, why is everything always so incredibly stupid? Has it always been this way? Whenever you watch old movies about politics like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington or All the President's Men, it all seems so noble and dignified. I can't imagine there's old newsreel footage of Harry Truman moving around to a Village People song. For example, the news found a way to get even dumber this week when newly released excerpts from a deposition revealed that Donald Trump said he was afraid that protesters during the 2016 election would throw dangerous fruits at him during a rally. In transcripts of an October 2021 deposition filed in court on Tuesday, the twice-impeached former president insisted tomatoes, pineapples, and bananas can be very dangerous weapons that justify violent acts of self-defense. They were going to throw fruit, he claimed, and you get hit with fruit, it's very violent stuff. We were on alert for that. To stop somebody from throwing pineapples, tomatoes, bananas, stuff like that, it's dangerous stuff.
That's why we had the security guards. Now me, I wanted to use some very highly specialized fruit ninjas. I said, let's do ninjas, because they have the fruit swords. But they said no, because if they miss three fruits, they're out, and you can't show weakness like that.
And then there's this even dumber part of the deposition where Trump says, you get hit with fruit, it's very violent stuff. We were on alert for that. I wanted to have people be ready because we were put on alert that they were going to do fruit. What do you mean, do fruit? What do you mean you were put on alert? There's an alert system for fruit? It's like the Homeland Security threat level. Red's tomato, yellow's for banana, and green is for avocado. And you know what they say, if you get hit with an avocado, you're toast. And that's today's brunch joke. Thank you. Also, how would somebody sneak a pineapple into a political rally? Oh, so you misheard. This isn't a pineapple. This is my baby. Her name is Penelope. Isn't that right, Penelope? Oh, Penelope has dry skin. We need some lotion. These idiots are somehow both the dumbest and most dangerous people in our politics. When they're not panicking about potential fruit-based assaults, they're actively planning to subvert free and fair elections. They did it in 2020. They were caught, lied about it, and they're preparing to do it again as we speak. Democracy is the target, and they've sunk to new lows, including declaring
martial law.
This has been a closer look. Let's move on.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Our guest tonight is a Tony Award-winning and Oscar-nominated actor you know from films such as Tick, Tick, Boom, The Eyes of Tammy Faye, and from his role in Angels in America on Broadway. He stars in FX's Under the Banner of Heaven. The first two episodes premiere tonight exclusively on Hulu. Please welcome back to the show, Andrew Garfield, everybody. Welcome back.
Hey.
Here with me.
Yeah.
you enjoy?
Thanks for coming.
That's very nice of you. That's a real power move for you. Yeah. Saying it's nice to have you here.
Nice to have you guys here.
for my late night show.
Thank you for joining us and letting yourself be joined.
Yes.
Congratulations on this show. This is a very famous book by Jon Krakauer.
Yeah.
Came out, I guess, over a decade ago, probably.
Yeah.
Did you read it when it came out?
I did. I kind of gobbled it up. It's an incredible book called Under the Banner of Heaven, as Seth said, by Jon Krakauer. And it's kind of a dissection of the Mormon faith and the history of Mormonism and connecting it to a modern kind of awful murder event that happened in the 80s in Utah. This amazing woman, Brenda Wright Lafferty, who had the courage as a woman in the Mormon faith to question the kind of patriarchal structure. And it's hopefully our series is an honoring of her and her memory and the memory of her daughter. And within it, I play a fictionalized character, a detective, Jeb Pyrie, who's also a Mormon going through his own crisis of faith as he is pursuing the truth of this case. So he's kind of stuck between, you know, the truth and his, family life, his community. He could potentially lose his wife and his kids if he starts to really unpick the foundations of his faith. It's kind of an interesting dilemma.
I knew you did a lot of research. You talked to a lot of people in the Mormon faith. We're not willing to go full method for the Mormonism, though, correct? As far as...
because I would require
more
than I'm willing to offer, yeah.
Because, like, you wouldn't be able to, like... I mean, you'd have to, like, know... No coffee, right?
No coffee. I think I'd have to be married to get to the celestial kingdom, which I'm not.
But the coffee.
I know the coffee. Yeah, exactly. No sugar. No, it's a really, you know, their body is their temple. And listen, there are so many things about the Mormon faith that I found really kind of, like the sense of community, and there's a real kind of kindness with modern Mormons. But yeah, the coffee thing, you know.
Yeah.
There's no way.
Cause you kind of like stop listening. They're like, it's community faith. Like, I'm sorry, I'm hung up on coffee right now. It's gonna be a hard time for me to move on. So you last time you were here, which is a while back now, you were talking about silence. You played a Jesuit priest in that.
Yeah.
Eyes of Tammy Faye, televangelist, and now this. Is it a coincidence, or is it interesting to jump into these? Because these movies aren't just about faith, but obviously this is a huge, or TV shows, I should say. It is an element to all.
Definitely.
Three.
But also, you know, I would even say, you know, Angels in America, which you mentioned, has is maybe the most spiritual kind of text of all of the things you've talked about. And it's like something like Tick, Tick, Boom, like Jonathan Larson was a kind of monk devotee of musical theater. Like, so there's a spiritual element to everything that I feel drawn to. And I think it's really about people reckoning with life and death and the deepest questions. And I think, weirdly enough, maybe Jim Baker is the least spiritual person I've ever played.
I bet that's really because he's just a con man.
Well, I don't know about that. I have to defend him a little bit, but he was definitely kind of seduced by the things that we're all seduced by, which is a kind of a sense of our own not enoughness, which makes ourselves, you know, feel like we need to fulfill ourselves through money and power and status and things that you wouldn't know anything about.
No, because for me, it's just coffee. That's for all. you know what I? I am a fan of true crime. I also do love when, in a project like this, it is paired with something else, right? It's not just about a mystery, like you mentioned. Like, it is a crisis of faith, both of the victim and, you know, the detective who's investigating the case. Are you a true crime fan yourself?
I do enjoy... I think recently I actually said this in an interview. I don't know why I'm repeating it again. Why am I doing this to myself? But someone said that we heard you love true crime, Andrew, and you're an easy sell on this. So I was like, yeah, are you saying I'm easy? Like, I'm a slut for true crime? Like, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, I guess I am a slut. I'm doubling down on
you're
being
doubling
a,
down, yeah.
a slut for true crime. For true crime.
Yeah.
Just for true crime.
You know, the problem is with digital technology today, they can just edit that last part off. You know, it's sort of...
And they can edit my outfit as well. And
there's a lot of... It's just your floating head saying, like, I'm a slut. Like a hard, hard cutout.
Oh, now someone is definitely going to do that.
Yeah, no, I really have laid out a pretty easy-to-follow roadmap there. you mentioned Angels in America. I saw you... in Death of a Salesman on Broadway. I think I talked about this last time you were there. When the night I saw it, I then went to a bar and you were there afterwards. Maybe I haven't. Mm. And you were talking to the woman who played your mother, who was wonderful.
Linda Emond. Yeah, the great Linda Emond.
And I really, it was too late. I realized it too late. But it was obviously such an intense show to perform. Yeah. And you guys were sort of deep in conversation. I just walked over and was like, hey, great job! And you're both like, And I realized it definitely takes them a little bit longer to get out of performing the show than it did for me to, like, watch seeing the show. And that was... that was Mike Nichols.
Yeah, directing it. Yeah,
and I just read his biography, which I loved, and I was wondering if you could tell me, because I only met him once. Yeah. Obviously, you know, here was this guy with this incredible career, and you would assume at the wide shot he was just like living on the high life, and yet it was really a book about how this great artist like was constantly had doubt.
Oh, yeah.
Even though it seemed like one of his skills was taking doubt away from the performers that he worked with.
That's so interesting. Yeah, I think that's true. I think. It's so reassuring when an icon and a legend exposes that they are just as insecure as you are. I remember one of the first... I have a story that just came to me now, perfect for a late-night show. imagine that. So I end of the first week of rehearsal, and I am riddled with insecurity, as one always is when one is putting on a play or making a film or doing anything human for that matter. Yeah. Just walking down the street, riddled with insecurity, and I remember coming up to Mike and him just kind of looking at me with this kind of benign, just kind of appreciation of me, and I'm just full of doubt. And he says, "You know, I'm not worried about you because you really don't think highly of yourself at all." And it was like a kind of blessing of the wound of being a person, of being someone who just struggles, like we all struggle. And to hear him say, "You're just like me," and it was like about a woundedness that I have, I was like, oh my God, you should be everyone's grandfather, whether they're in the theater or in film or otherwise. Like, and that was another thing about him is that he became a kind of mentor to everybody that he would meet. And I think that, like Sondheim became, you know. And it's just a beautiful thing. And the way he directed was he would tell stories. We would finish a scene at the table and he would tell some kind of seemingly inconsequential story about a party where he met Elia Kazan and asked him about, you know, naming names. And then he'd be like, okay, try it again. And then suddenly you're doing the scene properly because of some aspect of the story that is like affected your unconscious, and suddenly you're in the scene in a way that I don't know. He was a magician and elegant and deeply, deeply insecure.
I met him. Like I said, I met him once, and yet it was a very short interaction where I felt like he managed to transfer a little bit of light, and I thought, wow, you probably knew, you know, for the whole like sort of second half of your life, you knew that people wanted something from you, and he seemed very good at giving it.
I think he was one of those rare people that didn't want to be the richest man in the graveyard, but actually knew that we don't get to take anything with us. You know, we are meant to leave it all here. And I know Sondheim was like that. And I know that Mike was like that. And Rupert Murdoch doesn't seem to be like
less,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, slightly less.
I think if you had to order the three, I think like maybe Mike and Sondheim are like one, and then
coming in hot. Number three.
Maybe like, number three. Hey, last thing before you go, you know, there was a bit of a controversy here on the show when your Spider-Man co-star Tom Holland was here. Oh. And he said something.
What happened?
Well, he was talking about, you know, there were three Spider-Men in that last movie. You were one of them and he was one of them. And one suit, he mentioned that one, let's just take a look real quick.
I'll give you a spoiler, and I'm not going to tell you who, but one of us has a fake ass in their suit.
Really? Wow.
You can figure out that for yourselves.
Wow.
He's just stirring the pot, old Tom. He can't help himself. You know, there's an expression that we have in entertainment, which is we want to put bums on seats.
Yeah.
You know, we want to get the audience sat and paying their tickets. And Tom is pretty great at creating the sub-genres of games for you all while you're in the cinema going, well, that butt doesn't look real. Yeah. Toby's looks like it might be real.
Yeah.
Could Andrew have that much ass? Maybe. Yeah. Potentially.
So it seems like we're not going to get an answer for you. It seems like all I
know is that I am totally unmodified.
Uh-huh.
And that's all I can I can share. And I think Tom is very good at marketing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I'm not going to ask for more than that. You have given us a great gift as well. You guys, that's Andrew Garfield. FX was Under the Banner of Heaven premieres tonight on Hulu with new episodes available on Thursdays.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
What came first, the chicken or the egg? Spoiler alert, it's neither. At Happy Egg, we believe happiness of the hens is what actually came first, because without happy hens, there would be no such thing as happy eggs. You know, eggs with delicious orange yolks. Those come from hens who are raised the happy way on 8+ acres of family-owned farms. Choose happy at happyegg.com and look for the yellow carton at a store near you.
Happy
Egg.